Look, when my kids first heard about the Olympics coming to Brisbane in 2032, one of them casually turned to me, it was really funny, and said, look, Dad, what event should I compete in? In their mind, competing in the Olympics was as simple as just turning up and say, hey, look, I'll give it a go. So it took a bit of time to just lovingly explain, yeah, look, it's probably going to take a bit more commitment in the next 10 years than just just turning up and going, hey, can I do long jump or whatever. But here's the thing. We live in an age of Netflix, Uber Eats, FaceTime, TikTok. We can access libraries as vast as Alexandria at our fingertips. We gain university degrees all in the comfort of our homes. We can connect across oceans and countries and read news across those distances in a split second. Quick, fast. We can change jobs 10 times a year because we're not enjoying it and still be called a professional. We have so much instantly that it has created, I think, a casual approach to everything. And in particular, a casual approach to following Jesus. Like my kids, we go, yeah, I'll give that a go, without understanding the gravity of what we're saying we'll give it a go too. Here's my concern for us today. Jesus isn't some casual commitment. He isn't some side hustle, some shared Netflix subscription we can cancel whenever it's inconvenient. He's more than that. Jesus does more than just fit into our lives. He actually radically changes it. He re-envisions it. He lifts it out of the muck and mess and transforms it. He refines it like fire. Now, I get that may be hard for some of us to hear, but I think it's incredibly good news for anyone who hears it. Because here's the thing. You will follow something in your life. You will pursue something. You will fix your eyes. Whether it's you, your kids, your career, whatever it is, you will follow something. And I guess today's passage really hits at the heart of that by asking, what or who do you follow? And will you follow Jesus? The passage is short, but make no mistake, it packs a punch. Read with me if you have your Bibles there. Verse 18. When Jesus saw a large crowd around him, he gave the order to go to the other side of the sea. Look, now, if you don't know, Jesus has started to gain popularity, incredible popularity. No one's ever heard someone teach like Jesus teaches. No one's ever seen the things that Jesus can do. He heals diseases, any diseases, sickness, illness. Demons, flee from him. And he's transforming the lives of the most outcasted, inconsiderate people you can imagine. All of it is extraordinary. So people are flocking to him. Yet remember what I said last week. Jesus isn't in it for the fame. He's not his end game isn't look, how do I gather a crowd to really pander to my fame and fortune? I really want people to acknowledge me. He gets what he's here to do. And so Jesus has a bigger goal in mind. I don't know if you know this, but his name, Jesus, basically just means God saves, Yahweh saves. Ask the kids, they should have learned that, I think, about the kids. And Matthew, so the author of this gospel, who collated all these historical events, has clarified that Jesus, the one whose name God saves, has come to save people from their sins. That's how he starts the gospel. This is why Jesus has come. Out of love to address the greatest threat, illness, and concern that humanity faces. The great Emmanuel, God with us, God coming into our world, has come not to gather crowds, but to save people from their sins. In other words, to restore us back to God, to bring us into a relationship with a heavenly Father rather than a judge. He came to create new hearts that have been forgiven, cleansed, and transformed. He came to deal with the moral cancer within and without, to heal what we broke and bent, to defeat death and conquer evil. Jesus came to make us sons and daughters of God Most High, forever loved and forever His. And if you grasp this, you'll begin to understand that Jesus came more than just fanfare, than just a fickle following, that, you know, yeah, I'll give Jesus a go, but look, I've got other stuff. He came for you, and not just part of you, all of you. What Jesus came to accomplish by its very nature demands more than a casual subscription. It's a long way to highlight what Jesus does here in the text. It is simple but profound. He sees a large crowd gather. He's just done a lot of healing. The crowds are gathering, and he gives an order to go to the other side. You think, oh, yeah, Jesus probably just needs a break from the crowds. He probably is just getting a little sick of people, yeah, just probably just needs a bit of me time. But here's the thing with Jesus. He never does anything randomly. He's the most intentional person you'll ever meet, frustratingly so at times. Because Jesus has this real knack of just getting to the heart of things, to the very core of who you are, and sort of exposing and confronting you with something. So in front of the crowd, of this crowd, Jesus gives the order, not a request, by the way, it's an order, a command to go to the other side. Now quickly, who is he giving the order to? To the crowd? To his disciples, maybe. If you don't know what a disciple is, it's those who loved and followed Jesus. And many argue that that's the obvious answer. And I agree to an extent, but I'm going to argue he's giving the command to everyone around him. He's not trying to avoid the crowd. He's trying to address the heart of the crowds. Here's his command. If you will hear him, will you follow me? And two people respond. Read with me. A scribe approached him and said, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." Jesus told him, "Foxes have dens, and the birds of the sky have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head." Now quickly, a scribe was part of the social and spiritual elite in Jesus' day. They were usually tasked at copying, reading, and even at times explaining the scriptures to people. So you think of your Old Testament, your Bible. They were educated, which usually meant their family had money. It wasn't like today where everyone just had free public education. Typically, it was only the wealthy that could afford such an education. It's actually why all the scribes and the Pharisees were actually amazed by Jesus, who in their eyes was an uneducated carpenter, the son of a carpenter even. Yet, uneducated in the eyes, Jesus could dance with the best of them. Well, this scribe isn't that. He, by all circumstances, seems to be a great candidate to follow Jesus. He's wealthy, he's educated, and he knows the scriptures. So he says, "Teacher, I will follow you, ready? Wherever you go." Now, right from the bat, you haven't sort of picked it up. The scribe has a very different perspective to Jesus than what the leper and the Roman centurion had last week. I don't know if everyone remembers, how did the leper and the centurion reference Jesus? Was it teacher? It was actually Lord. A Roman centurion who only bows to Caesar alone called this peasant Jew Lord, Master. The scribe was willing to follow Jesus as a teacher, as a rabbi, but his view on Jesus fell pretty short. The nuance is important because if all you see in Jesus is some sort of guru teacher, like you think about that in your life, if you just need a teacher that you can click onto and give me some tips and let me get back to my life, in the long run, you will eventually give up on it. You will never see why it's worth enduring as a Christian what we endure if Jesus is just your teacher. This scribe saw little of Jesus. He's not master. He's not king. He's not Emmanuel. He's not God saves. He's teacher. Yet he makes the bold claim all the same. "I will follow you wherever you go, Jesus. You're going across the sea? I'm coming." As I said, the most loving and frustrating thing about Jesus, though, is he sees your heart. And he always goes for it. So listen to Jesus' response. It's pretty random if you don't know what Jesus is doing. That's what he says. Foxes have dens, and birds of the sky have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head. Firstly, let me just clarify. He shrewdly uses the title Son of Man to refer to himself. He uses it often in the Gospels. And I think he uses it shrewdly because it both captures his humanity and his divinity. It's an incredibly clever term. Like, the Son of Man just means you are a son of man. He is human in every respect. He gets the tension of having a home or not having a home, of being hungry or being full. He gets the frailty of what it is to be a human being. Yet if you understand where that title comes from, you've got to hold it in tension with what is prophesied in Daniel 7, that there is a Son of Man who will one day inherit and rule all things beside God. And if you know your scriptures, your Bible, God never shares his throne with anyone but God himself. He is Emmanuel, God with us. So what Jesus is saying is both earthly, if you like, and heavenly. Both practical and deeply philosophical, if you like. Both temporal and eternal. You see, this scribe who most likely grew up tasting the best of life in terms of the material. Remember, he was wealthy, he was educated. He probably had an inheritance, a home. An earthly one. And Jesus has said to him, foxes and birds have homes, but I don't. And by implication, neither will you if you follow me. Animals will have homes, but you won't. Will you still follow me? Let that sink in for a moment. Will you follow Jesus if that meant you would never have a place to lay your head, a place to rest, a place of comfort and security here on earth, a place where you belong? Would you? Like, are you going, yep, I'll sign up to that? I'll come back to this in a moment, but I'm going to let it hang. I want us to meet the next candidate. Look with me, verse 21. Lord, another of his disciples said, first, let me go bury my father. But Jesus said to him, follow me and let the dead bury their own dead. From the bat, this guy seems like a better candidate. I mean, he seems, like it says, he's a disciple. He's already a follower of Jesus. And did you hear how he referred to Jesus? It wasn't anything else. It was Lord, Master, King even. Yet as soon as Jesus gave to the command, remember, to the whole crowd, let's go to the other side of the sea, the stakes became real for this so-called disciple, a person who claimed to be dedicated to following Jesus. So did you listen to his response? Let me read it quickly again. Lord, first, like, I know you said let's go over there, but first let me go bury my father. Now, if anyone has an excuse, this guy did, don't you think? Like, that sounds reasonable, doesn't it? Let me bury my father, and then I'll come. Again, Jesus goes for the heart, and he doesn't play. There is something larger at stake. Listen to what he says. Follow me. Again, command. It's an imperative. It's follow me. And let the dead bury their own dead. Now, this response not only sounds confronting, but incredibly harsh and insensitive. Doesn't it? Or maybe it's just me. Like, if I was to go to the funeral of my parents and Jesus said that to me, maybe you're cool, but that would grate on me. It actually grates so much that even commentators, the people who spend their time studying and unpacking the Bible, try their hardest to lessen the blow by explaining what is meant by this disciple's request. Like, the obvious reading is that, you know, his dad has just died, can you let me bury it? But, like, some argue that what this disciple means is that his dad isn't dead yet, and what he's asking Jesus permission for is that, look, can I wait till my dad dies, which could be years ahead, and then I'll come follow you. Now, that sounds more acceptable because you can filter Jesus' response in a less harsher light, if that's the case. But regardless of which option you choose about the disciples' intention, you can't deny the force of Jesus' words. Like, it still remains. Regardless if he said, look, you're burying your dad now or later, his command to him is still follow me and let the dead bury their own dead. Now, look, I need to clarify a couple of things here. Jesus isn't trying to be harsh. Remember, he sees his heart. It isn't that he's unloving or uncaring, or that he lacks any of the social intelligence to know, hey, Jesus, we don't say stuff like that, Jesus. The Son of Man understands the plight and struggle of humanity. But he is trying to emphasize something of infinite importance. So much so that it confronts even going to your dad's funeral. He wants the disciples, and by implication, us, to grasp what it means to follow him. Look, I remember when we moved up to Brizzy. I came from New South Wales, and I remember there was just heaps of ads about fire safety or fire readiness. Did you have a fire plan? And I was really nervous because I was like, I don't. Do I need to get one? Like, I don't know. Like, I've never had a fire plan. But the ads on TV were constantly, do you have your fire plan? And I remember how a lot of the advice would sort of, apart from prevention, you know, like clear, I think it was like clear your gutters and make sure you put away dead leaves and grass. But a lot of the advice was prepare to leave. If the fire has arrived, don't try to fight it or rescue your material possessions. They were just really clear. Save your life. Like, flee. The words were trying to be unloving or say that what you were about to lose was insignificant. They were just highlighting that there was something more valuable at play. And this is the force of Jesus' words. He's not trying to be unloving or insensitive. He's trying to help us understand that following him is a matter of life and death. I'd argue the greatest thing you can do is make a decision around this. It's greater even than burying a father. And I get that this can all sound a little too intense, a little too full-on, dramatic. But I'd argue again that if you've grasped who Jesus is, what he has done, and what he's calling you to, this is the most loving thing he can say to you. Follow him. Let me shift gears for a moment now. I've unpacked, if you like, the passage, and it is short, but I want to change gears and come back around to see what Jesus is doing by zooming out a little bit. Because I think Jesus addresses profoundly two major tensions any disciple will face, a follower of Jesus, someone who loves him, who says, hey, I think I want to commit to him. Two tensions that were felt over 2,000 years ago and are felt even today. I'm just going to summarize them. You can name them however you want. The tensions of home and family. I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute. But for now, I want to argue that these tensions can become our greatest hindrance to following Jesus, because we often don't see what Jesus is offering when it comes to home and family. We think that here's Jesus and then here's home and family. That somehow Jesus is making you choose one over the other. And in a sense, that's true. But if you understand what Jesus offers, you'll understand how home and family actually makes sense in Jesus, and pursuing home and family separate from him doesn't. I remember when Dad was teaching me to drive, which is years ago now, he gave me this really helpful advice, which might sound really obvious to some, but he was always like, just keep your eyes ahead. Especially when it came to, I don't know when you first drive, but it was always like the fear of like, what if I go out of the lines? Well, I had that as I started driving. And he said, no, just keep your eyes to the front. Don't look down. You can try it. Like, you try driving as you get out and just focus immediate to what you're driving and not look for. Actually, don't, because then if you crash, they'll be like on the news, pastor told congregants to drive bad. But like kids do this all the time. So if you're teaching them to teach them how to ride their bike, the most common thing they do is just look at the ground and look at their feet, right? And you've got to go, no, lift your head and look ahead. Because if you don't, they wobble and they crash because they can't comprehend what they're doing. They can't navigate the road they're on. But by looking ahead, you can put everything into context. Where are you going? What are you doing? And this is what Jesus has been trying to do with his disciples, with those who say that they would follow him. Jesus doesn't take away the tensions of home and family because he wants us to grasp the larger vision of them. He wants us to grasp what these tensions point to because they do point to something. So let's deal with the first one, home. I do want to clarify this. Jesus doesn't say owning a home is wrong. You can ask the question later if you want. But he does say if our sole dependence is upon an earthly home, it is empty and fleeting. Like, you think of the floods, the fires. Like, none of those people could stop it. None of them, even the insurance companies that are trying to make sense of how they pay this mess, the government that's trying to subsidize, no one can guarantee your home life here. But like, a home is more than just bricks and mortar, isn't it? A home can epitomize the nature of your wealth. Look at my home. It can epitomize a place of belonging. This is where I live. This is where I can be me. It can epitomize for us hope and security. And I'd actually argue that the reason all of us want home or a home is because it's wired within us to desire it. We all want home, a place that is ours, a place where we belong, a place where we can be safe and we can rest. And Jesus knows this. Like, even if you're the person that just loves to travel, and I'm not a home person, Pierre, I like to just stay in like different places. I would argue your heart is still longing for a place where it can feel settled, satisfied, secure. You're looking for a home, so you travel across the nations, finding it. So what Jesus challenges the scribe in and us is, where do we find our home? You see, following Jesus means we're able to frame things rightly. We're able to see the eternal perspective as well as the temporal. When we love and follow Jesus, we're able to be wise and loving, generous and sacrificial with what we have, because we know that this isn't all there is. Our home here isn't ultimate, because our home, our true home, is somewhere else. So yes, Jesus does say to us, if you follow him, you will have no true home here. But if you know Jesus, he also said, I'm going to prepare a place for you. Does he not? He's leading us to our true home. And we trust that the home that Jesus is preparing for us isn't made with bricks and mortar, but something stronger and deeper. A true home that will never spoil, fail, or fade. His home will become our home. A true home that will satisfy our hearts, bring true comfort to the soul, bring the fullness of joy. Like, we've just had Christmas. I don't know how all your Christmases were, but there is a joy to it if you know what it is to spend it in a home with those you love. His house has pleasures forevermore. We play around with all sorts of things in our life trying to satisfy. Jesus goes, no, my house has pleasures that don't just last a minute, a day, or even a month or a year. My pleasures are forevermore. The home he prepares for us is more secure than the earth itself. It's more mightier than the mountains and castles that human beings can create and behold. It will be a home where you will never doubt your belonging. A home where you can truly be who you are. Every billboard, I don't know if you noticed this, from here to Springfield, will sell you the lie. buy a home, and everything will be okay. Your dreams, once you spend over $500,000, you will be complete. You will find paradise on earth. Just keep your eyes on the ground. Don't lift them up. Here is, like Ripley Valley, this is where you want to be. Come on, really? Like, I had a whole section just unpacking that statistically, of just how it's impacted our finances, the rise of anxiety and fear and mental health at homes, the rise of domestic violence in these so-called new paradises. You can buy the lie, friends, or you can see what Jesus offers you. He says to our hearts, follow me and I have a better home. Foxes have dens, birds have nests. I don't have a place to lay my head here, but you will one day have one that is far glorious than the stars in the universe. Again, I'm not saying you can't own a home, but can we be more concerned with our heavenly home than in a place to rest our heads here? Look, I was going to hesitate to share this, but my mum and dad were immigrant. I was immigrant too. I was 3 years old when we came to Australia. And I'll never forget the way that mum and dad pursued life here in Australia. Everyone, all their family that came over from Peru wanted to pursue the Australian dream of just working to buy a home. And I remember one time, dad with tears, during Christmas, we weren't rich, we were very poor. I grew up most of my life in one-bedroom apartments. I remember him saying one day, like, I got a basketball for Christmas, which I thought was one of the best presents I had ever, but he was apologising in tears. He said, I'm sorry, because when I came to Australia, I wasn't going to compromise on my faith. You see, all my family members that pursued the Australian dream worked weekends. They worked most week nights. Mum and Dad never compromised coming to church. Mum and Dad, most nights, would hold prayer meetings in their house. I had some of the best memories laying at my parents' feet while grown-ups were praying, calling out to the Lord. I never regret the inheritance they gave. That inheritance is far greater than an earthly one. By an infinite stretch. Which leads us to family, the second tension. Now, you think about the crucial and fundamental relationships, how crucial and fundamental relationships are to a person. We were created for relationships. Both the way that God's woven it into our DNA and hearts. If you're a human being, not only do you come into this world through relationship. Like, you didn't just pop out. But it's woven in the very desires and longings we have as human beings. To connect, to belong, to be known and to know. And even if you're the biggest introvert and hermit on the planet, I'd still argue your heart longs for connection, for relationship, for someone to know you that you need space. You want someone to understand that when you're quiet, it's not because you hate them. All of us crave relationship. And if you think even a little bit deeper than that, you think about relationships that every human being has on earth, family is as close as you can get. I also understand that it's also the most broken relationships you can get as well. I get that. But everyone is someone's son or daughter. As I said, there is no perfect family. My family, for all the good that they did, weren't perfect. Like, my parents come often, you can ask them. But your family are some of the closest and most intimate relationships you will ever have. It's why the sting or hurt of them are so deep when they don't function as they should or you don't ever experience them at all. And here Jesus says to his followers, a disciple that had said, I will follow you, Jesus. He said to him, let me bury my dad. And look, I don't know the disciples, but let's for a moment say that he loves his father. Jesus says to him, I am the most important relationship you will ever have. More important than a father or mother. More important than a husband or wife. More important even than your child or friend. No matter how you look at this, how you want to spin it, Jesus doesn't compromise on the importance of who he is or should be if you were to follow him. And I get what that sounds like for our ears because we run the calculations, don't we? Wait, you know, my wife is pretty important, my children, my friends, my family, like, Jesus comes first? Yes. It is for Jesus an all-in type of deal. Jesus, for a Christian, for someone who says, I will follow Jesus, becomes everything. And yes, you might say, wow, this is really intense for you. But here's the thing. If you understand who he is, what he's calling you to, and what he's done, you will see and understand that what he's calling you to isn't a compromise of those relationships, but the fulfillment of them. You see, whether you want to acknowledge it or not, relationships still shape, mold, and determine who you are. So let's put Jesus away for a minute. Let's say you as like just a person. Relationships mold and shape and sort of define who you are. You think of the massive cultural crisis we have around gender identity. You think of the war this is of belonging. And what I find like just the irony of just expressive individualism. In other words, you do you. If you want to be ABC, you can do that. You just do you, right? That's our cultural message. The crisis of identity, the pressure that expressive individualism sort of pushes on us is the pressure you need to be whatever you want to be unless I disagree. If I disagree, that's not on. Just the irony of that just really grates me on so many levels, not just theologically. But that's how our culture works. Be you as long as I don't get angry about it. And if I get angry about it, you will hear about it. Jesus says to his disciples in no uncertain terms, I am first, follow me. And that is incredible news. Because here's what I want to clarify with Jesus' response to his disciple. Relationship with Jesus isn't at the expense of all other relationships, but rather for the benefit of them all. As I said, it's the fulfillment of those relationships. You think of any relationship, whether it's a workmate, a family member, like a husband, wife, a partner, a boyfriend, girlfriend, a child, whatever. You think of every relationship, and I'd argue, I'll go toe-to-toe with you by saying that Jesus, if you put him first in every case, allows those relationships to flourish like no other relationship. You see, the problem Jesus is addressing with his disciple and both before the whole crowd who is listening to this interaction isn't just the seriousness of what it means to follow Jesus, but the heart problem of idolizing relationships in our lives. In other words, making other relationships as functional gods, saviors in our life, whether it be your husband, your wife, your girlfriend, boy, like we would go, my husband, my wife, this magical unicorn of the one that one day I will meet will make me complete. Or if I just have a child, that will complete me. Or like I just need that really good mate. Like my family just completely. My friends mean everything. Jesus knows how easily we make these relationships as the ultimate thing in our lives. And if you don't know this, can I give you some free advice? Human beings make for poor gods. We do. The moment I love my wife, you can ask her about this, the moment I make everything in my life about her is the moment I crush her, is the moment she will never bear under the weight of my expectations that I have for her. It's me looking at the ground trying to navigate life. And Jesus knows this about us. He knows that we fall and crash and burn every time we do it. And so Jesus wants us to lift our heads and he wants us to see the vision he set before us about life. The rhythm and patterns of these relationships are meant to play too. He's not a megalomaniac or some insecure deity. Remember, he's not in it for the fame. Well, he's trying to show us the depth and substance of every relationship through the one who created all things and came up with the idea of relationships. He's trying to help us see every relationship right. Because the moment that you look ahead and you see Jesus first, the way you love your children, the way you love your family, your friends, your workmates, your husband and wife makes sense. And he's also trying to show us the seriousness of what is at stake. You see, I said earlier that following Jesus is a matter of life and death. Like, this may be hard to wrestle with, but the text goes there. Every relationship you have is temporal. It's finite. It's limited. In other words, death will eventually catch up to it. One day death or something else will crush the relationship you've placed your hopes in. Unless Jesus came to do what he said he came to do, to die and rise again. Him conquering death means that death no longer has the final say in your life and by God's grace, any other relationship who knows him. So Jesus says, let the dead bury the dead because I am about the living. I'm about eternal relationships, forever relationships. Jesus came to give us a forever relationship with God and his people. And every other relationship is a whisper, a shadow, a precursor to that relationship. Evie, our eldest daughter, like she's 10, gorgeous girl. She still loves hanging out with us, which I think is really cool. Don't know how long it will last, but it's cool. And she recently, we were doing sort of Bible time together. We do it every night. And she just bursted out into tears. And I had no idea why she was so upset. And then I realized the study that we're looking at was talking about heaven. And I was like, oh, sweetie, why are you so upset? And she's old enough to comprehend and she's seen death in her life enough to know what that means. And she looked around her family that she loved so much. She said, Dad, I don't want this to stop. Dad, you say heaven is so good, but what if when I get there, I can't see you? What if when I get there, I can't hang out with you? Like, I don't care how tough you are. Hearing your child express that longing is just mind-blowing. It is so humbling. But I had this beautiful opportunity to point her to that, sweetie, as good as this is, as much as you enjoy our earthly family, this is just a taste of what it's like when Christ returns. Amen? The wonder Jesus is telling us that is as good as any relationship you have here is, it does not compare to what he's offering. She's still not convinced fully, but one day I hope she will. Jesus says, follow me and let the dead bury their dead. We don't get the responses of the scribe and disciple. You know, I'd argue that's intentional. You just don't know. As a reader, like if you know how narratives are written, it sort of leaves you in suspense. Because it leaves us asking the question, will you follow Jesus? Will you follow Jesus if it comes at the cost of home and family? can I say that the beauty of the gospel is that Jesus has something so much better prepared for you. Look, join us for the rest of the weeks that are coming, because obviously this gospel builds on not just this moment where he encounters two disciples, but it builds the case of who Jesus is. So come, and if you're not convinced of this, come and check him out. Come here next week and the week after and hear what Jesus says and does as we encounter him. But for today, can I ask you, will you follow him? Let me pray.